Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 267, The Horse Boy, with Rupert Isaacson. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
In that same year, as I was saying before, I had to bring this delegation of Bushmen hunter-gatherers to the United Nations in the State Department. And some of these guys were trained healers. Some of them worked on Rowan. Got an amazing result. He started losing some of his obsessive behaviors. So it was a very natural thing. It wasn't so much an idea. It was kind of, okay, he's had this radical and positive reaction to the horses, radical and positive reaction to these shamans. I could go to Africa tomorrow, but that's not a horse culture. Where combines shamanism and horses? That's Mongolia. Oh, my gosh. If we went there, we could travel on horseback from shaman to shaman. And I just got this gut feeling, if we do that, something's going to change.
That was the voice of my guest, travel author and film producer, Rupert Isaacson, speaking about his decision to take his wife and autistic son on a trip by horseback across Mongolia in search of a shaman who could heal the young boy. Rupert Isaacson was born in London in 1967 to South African parents. He also grew up training horses on his aunt's farm. A journalist since 1990, he has written for most of the British and many American newspapers and magazines. He's been a human rights activist since 1996, working for the Bushmen of Southern Africa's Kalahari Desert in their attempts not to be moved from their ancestral lands. His organization, the Indigenous Land Rights Fund, won the two largest land claims in African history in 2006 and 2011. As a result, he is banned from Botswana. In 2004, his son Rowan was diagnosed with autism and also began speaking while riding on horseback with Rupert. In 2007, Isaacson and his son Rowan rode across Mongolia. The journey was documented in the book and film, The Horse Boy. Rowan came back with a very different son. Since 2007, Rupert Isaacson has run the Horse Foundation, which helps autism families come together with horses and teaches people how to work with autism spectrum children and horses. He regards autism as a skill set rather than a disorder and is amazed at the sheer adventure of it all. Now, here's the interview. Rupert Isaacson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
I am thrilled to have this opportunity to speak with you about your acclaimed film, The Horse Boy, as well as your book on the same topic, both of which describe your family's healing journey across Mongolia by horseback, seeking a cure for your young son's autism. Actually, I didn't know anything about your horse boy adventure before my recent interview with your psychologist wife, Dr. Kristen Neff, about her new book on self-compassion. And I noticed something about the horse boy film and the tagline on her emails, and I realized this was a significant story in its own right, and so I was careful to steer clear of the topic in my interview with her, waiting to devote a whole episode to it, which we can do right now.
Well, I'm very honored. Thank you.
Well, let's start farther back with your own background, growing up in a couple of different countries and the career you eventually pursued.
Yes. Well, I'm born in the UK, but my parents are both from Africa. And in fact, my family had been in Africa since the, early 1700s. My sister and I were the first ones born out of Africa.
Was that South Africa?
On my mother's side, South Africa. On my father's side, what was Rhodesia, what's now Zimbabwe.
Okay.
But I was born in London, and we would shuffle back and forth a little bit between Africa and England. And I was always one of these kids that, although I was in the city, longed for green space. And horses are in my blood. A lot of my forebears were cavalry and had their own irregular cavalry regiments and so on and so on. And these things sometimes skip a generation. So my mother, for example, was, you know, didn't get her, my father didn't get him. But me, you know, I was a horse obsessive from the first time I could open my eyes and see one. So after much argument, I finally had a little junk stall at a flea market when I was 12. And I used to buy and sell junk. And I made enough money by 14 to buy a horse, and I bought a horse.
Oh, wow.
And it went from there, really.
Oh, wow. I can really identify with your junk stall.
Did you have one too?
I didn't have a junk stall, but I did go picking through neighbors' trash barrels looking for treasures and often found, you know, just wonderful treasures.
It's amazing what you find. Yeah, absolutely. People check out really good stuff all the time.
Yes. Okay, so that's a fascinating part of your story. And then you got into a career of journalism. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, that's also in the blood. You know, a lot of my family have been journalists and writers and storytellers of one kind or another. And so in many ways, I'm just a chip off the block. And I fell into journalism and travel writing and so on and became a guidebook writer and then a political journalist. And, of course, it was natural for me to get my stories in Africa because that's where I was connected to. I eventually, in the mid-90s, heard a fascinating report of some bushman hunter-gatherers in the country of South Africa, where I had always assumed the genocide had been so complete that there were no actual bushmen left. I mean, there were other tribes, but the bushmen were the oldest tribe of all, these sort of elusive, live deep in the bush, hunting and gathering people. The accepted wisdom is they had completely disappeared from South Africa, but it turns out they hadn't. There was a small group of them living by the side of the road who were kicked out of a national park in the 1970s. And although all through apartheid they had eked out their living literally by sort of begging, stealing, whatever they could do, when Mandela came to power after apartheid, there was a brief period where if you could prove that your community had been forcibly relocated under apartheid and could get a land claim in to the government by a certain date, there was a pretty strong chance you'd get that land back. So these bushmen heard about this, managed to get themselves a lawyer, and put in a claim, and the claim was for half a national park. And I looked at this, and this is the area where a lot of my family come from, in the Northern Cape. And like I say, we've been in Africa a long time, so not all of my family is white. And my non-white family, this is their area. And I had this gut feeling, I'm like, I bet you I have some family connection to this story. So I went down to start reporting on it, and I didn't think they'd win at all. And I spent a lot of time with the community, and then I found out that I was, in fact, related to them by marriage. And everything sort of changed at that point, and it became a very personal involvement, and I lost all my journalistic objectivity. And I ended up becoming an advocate for them, and they ended up winning their land back. And I wrote a book about this called The Healing Land. Now, that culture, the Bushmen, and like all hunting and gathering cultures on the planet, practice two systems of traditional medicine. They have you know, the natural pharmacology of plants and trees and so on that they use for, you know, drugs. But they also use going into a state of altered consciousness, what we call trance, in order to heal. And however skeptical one might be about that, you cannot but notice when you spend time with these people that they get sick and they get better using this. And one thing led to another. I ended up seeing an awful lot of this stuff. I saw how they were harnessing it for their political process. After the Bushmen in South Africa, I got asked to advocate for another group in a neighboring country in Botswana, a much bigger land claim. And I had to bring this group to the United Nations and the U.S. State Department. That was the same year that my son Rowan got diagnosed with autism. It was also the same year, this is 2004, that he went through my neighbor's fence and threw himself in front of my neighbor's quarter horse mare, Betsy, and forged an extraordinary connection with her. And I started riding with him, and he started speaking. So all these things happened in the same year. When I was shepherding these bushmen around America, some of them were trained healers in their culture, and they offered to do a little bit of work on him. And I knew that that really just entails a bit of prayer. So I was like, fine, go for it, you know. To my surprise and my wife's surprise, for about 4 or 5 days while he was with these guys, Rowan started to lose some of his worst symptoms. He fell back into them when they went home, but I couldn't help but notice, okay, he's had this radical and positive reaction to these Bushman shamans. He's had this radical and positive reaction to the horse. We've tried every other therapy under the sun, and I could bore you for 3 hours telling you every single therapy that we tried, none of which had had such strong reactions. So it was very natural for me to think, where is a place that combines this type of healing with this with horses? Because I could go to Africa tomorrow. I know these guys, but that's not a horse culture. Where is it? Well, that's Mongolia. So okay, we have to take him to Mongolia.
Okay, well, let me jump in here, because you're moving well through the story, but I wanted to just back you up just a little bit to because you tell a wonderful story about how you met your wife, Kristen.
Yes.
And take us through that.
Like I said, I used to be a travel writer as well as a journalist, and I got hired to write a guidebook to India. And I went there, and I'm tootling about like you do, taking notes and so on. And you're never in one place for more than about 48 hours when you do that job, because you've got to cover so much. So I was in this little town in the south called Mysore. And I'd have been up in the hills, staying with another tribe, actually. It's something I do quite a lot of, is staying with different tribes. And so I was looking pretty rough when I came out. And I had this night, this free night in a hotel that had been given to me as part of my travel writing gig. And it was full of Europeans. And I went out to the pool, Europeans and Americans, and I went out to the pool. They all had these perfect bodies. And I was like, this is extraordinary. Everyone has a perfect body. Every single body type, perfect. And of course, I was feeling a bit insecure and pudgy and, you know. I was like, what's the story here? They're like all these gods and goddesses. And it turns out that Mysore is the seat of Ashtanga Yoga. It's where Ashtanga Yoga, kind of yoga that Madonna does and Sting does, and all these sort of iconic people. And it gives you kind of this perfect body if you do it enough. But that was the story. And there was this whole scene there, because this is where the guy that is the sort of guru of this type of yoga lived. And so I was feeling quite insecure, and then my eye fell on this stunning woman in a swimsuit, and I had this weird feeling of, not really feeling, like a voice in my head just said, that's your wife, go marry her. And I didn't want to hear that at all, so I jumped into the pool and swam around for a bit, and it kept going. And I was like, well, if that's really the case, A, she's out of my league, and B, I'm only here for 48 hours, and I don't want, you know. But the voice wouldn't go away, so I kind of went into overdrive, and sort of bored her into submission, really. Because for the first 24 hours, she wouldn't talk to me. So, you know, I had hair down to my waist, and she's like, oh, another hippie in India, you know. So I made sure that I talked to her friends a lot about what an interesting life I led as a journalist and so on, within earshot. so that she wouldn't judge me so harshly. And finally, I sort of ended up managing to have a rather crazy conversation with her, which I said, listen, you know, you're going to think I'm completely bonkers. And I am a bit bonkers, it's true. Nonetheless, you know, this is what I'm getting loud and clear. What do you think about that? You know, mad, eh? And she said, well, I wouldn't touch me with a barge pole, because I'm a bit mad too. I've just come out. In fact, I'm married, but I've just left my husband for another man, and I'm hoping that this other man is going to leave his wife, but it's not looking very hopeful, and I'm a complete mess, and, you know, don't come near me, which, of course, is like waving a red line, you know. And so the next thing we knew, we were traveling around India together, and the next thing we knew after that, we were living in the USA because she's American. She had to come back and finish her PhD at Berkeley. She's a psychologist, and I'm a very ideal academic husband because I can go wherever. My work's very portable. We ended up in Austin, Texas, because she got a job at University of Texas. And Austin, as many people, many listeners will know, is a great place. And settled and started enjoying ourselves, had a kid. And then, of course, everything fell apart because you had the autism.
As I recall from your book, you two actually had an extended honeymoon before that, didn't you, of traveling around the world together?
Yes, oh, totally. And
for
it wasn't even really
years.
Just an extended honeymoon. It was how we made our living, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I'm a journalist and a travel writer, so, I mean, for me, travel is work. And suddenly when, you know, the diagnosis came and we had this obsessive child who couldn't deal with transitions and so on, I had to think, well, gosh, I can't. It's my livelihood gone. I mean, what am I going to do?
Yes.
Go get a job at, you know, in the supermarket? I don't know. You know, what am I going to do? It was quite scary.
Well, just to step back again just a little bit, I can totally understand you're falling in love with your wife. The photos in her book, and when I first saw it.
You haven't seen those photos. Oh, you mean those photos?
I thought, whoa, man, this is a ravishing woman. I was glad I was interviewing her on the phone rather than in person. Not sure I could handle it in person. So then.
I'll tell you that. She'll be very happy.
Yeah, you can tell her that. And I'm glad I'm interviewing you on the phone so I don't get punched.
No, I'm the opposite. I would fight for my wife's dishonor. Like, what, my wife's not good enough to flirt with? I work on the inverse psychology, you know.
Yeah. So you had, you know, you had a son, Rowan, who at first was developing along expected lines, right?
Yeah,
but then
fairly normally.
Around 2004, he was diagnosed as autistic.
Yeah.
How did that come about? What were the primary symptoms of his autism?
It was obsession, really obsessive, repetitive behaviors, lining up of toys, and missing certain milestones like pointing and so on. If you're married to a psychologist, you know she's obviously trained in developmental psychology. She started noticing there were things he wasn't doing.
Yes.
And then he had some speech. He was starting to speak. Around one, and then it just all sort of went away, and then these terrible, terrible tantrums began, which were quite otherworldly. It was clear that these weren't just "I'm not getting what I want and I'm pissed off" tantrums. This was, you know, some sort of trauma and some sort of fear reaction or pain reaction. But because he wasn't verbal, we couldn't get to the bottom of it.
Yes.
You know, in retrospect, what I know that they were reactions to getting the wrong information through the nervous system, which is typical of regressive autism, that they have these terrible sensory conditions where, you know, wind could feel like a flamethrower or your clothes could suddenly feel like they weigh 10 tons. And this could happen any time of the day or night because suddenly the wrong switch is flipped.
Yes.
In the neurology, and more is being understood about it now. But back then, even people were very much in the dark. So all you know is that your child is in so much pain that they're knocking their heads against the wall, and you know, crying all the time, screaming and losing it. And you have to nothing you can do while that's going on except stop them from self-harming and waiting for the juggernaut to pass, and it's happening. 5, 6, 7, 8, 12 times a day, and your life is shutting down.
Yes, and you were a little bit slow to recognize the autism because one of the primary symptoms was missing, which was typically we think of autistic people as not engaging in eye contact, but he actually gave good eye contact.
Yes, exactly. I remember Kristen saying, well, you know, something's wrong with him, but, you know, hey, at least it's not autism because, you know, he makes good eye contact and he's so affectionate. In fact, that it's a myth. It's a complete myth that autistic people have trouble with empathy and eye contact. There's a small minority of them that have some issues with that, but probably no more than the small minority of other types of people.
Hmm.
Most people on the autism spectrum make fine eye contact and are quite empathetic. They show it and express it differently, but, you know, they are. So that did delay our identifying it by about 6 months or so, but finally Kristen kind of one day strapped on some lady balls and kind of went up to the computer and just sort of typed in autism early symptoms, you know, and there were 10 and he had 9.
Yes, yes.
So it was like, okay. The only one he didn't have was lack of eye contact.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you tried a number of interventions, and I know in the book you discuss ABA, which I think stands for Applied Behavioral Analysis.
Yes.
And none of them worked.
Or the Wehrmacht. I think Hitler had an ABA section in Mein Kampf. it's a pretty, if it's wrongly applied, it's a pretty, pretty coercive, is the polite word, form of getting kids to be, this terrible word, compliant. And it the idea of it is a sound idea. It's that by modeling appropriate behaviors and getting kids to repeat them and imitate them, they will eventually learn them sort of by a sort of certain Pavlovian response, if not cognitively. And that's actually a fairly sound methodology. The only problem with it is the application. Many people who practice ABA, not all, and it's getting better, but many people who practice ABA are extremely rigid in the way they do it, and they will sort of lock themselves in a room with a child, no matter how much the child throws themselves at the door and cries and screams and obviously shows trauma. They will sort of hold fast in that sort of like the old idea of letting a baby cry it out to sleep by itself. You know, it's just, if the baby's crying because you left it in the cot by itself, that might mean that there are good sound reasons for not leaving it in the cot by itself. But, you know, it's an old school form of looking at children. And it's funny. I remember the first couple of times that these therapists came out, we tried it. Not only was our kid hating it, but they were charging us an arm and a leg.
Yes.
I mean, the average price tag for a year of ABA is 50 to 80 grand. Why? Why?
No,
why does it have to be just like half a house?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
For 1 year. I think that's obscene. I think that, you know, you've got these parents who are struggling financially, and you come in and you sort of fearmonger them. You say, well, if you don't do this, you know, you're not being a responsible parent and you're going to lose your child and blah, 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 and all this absolute rubbish. Rather like evangelical preachers.
Yeah.
And then you sell through fear something which costs an insane amount of money. I mean, why does it have to cost an insane amount of money? Well, people would say, that's because it's got to be like a 40-hour, you know, program. But most of the 40 hours is done actually by the family. The family have to be done. And the idea is the entire family has to sort of live their life according to the schedule written out on the fridge, and you mustn't deviate from the schedule. Or the, I remember looking at this and going, this is not real life. You know, even if it worked in the short term, all it would do would be to prepare Rowan for a set of expectations that life cannot possibly deliver on. We are the kind of family that has to get on a plane just to go see the grandparents. You know,
yeah.
It's not going to work. You know, we need something better. Weirdly, though, I could see how some of the, before, you know, all the ABA listeners, you know, show up at your doorstep with pitchforks and torches. You know?
Right.
I qualify what I say by saying I think that the methodology is quite sound, but I think the application is unsound, and I'll tell you why. It's because I'm a horse trainer. So I understand how to train animals that don't speak my language,
mm-hmm.
that are fear-based and suffer from high anxiety, and very similar to autistic people,
yes.
yet who are social and motivated to connect. And the stakes with horses are much, much higher. If you make a real mistake with a horse, you can get killed. And if you're training the horses to do really complex things, like, say, circus tricks or high school dressage, or this kind of, when I train horses to do this kind of thing, you have to work through intrinsic motivation, not extrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. If I know a horse likes treats, I use treats. If I know a horse likes a lot of physical affection, I use a lot of physical affection. If I know the horse likes to be in this corner of the field, I train him there. And then gradually I bring him to the point where I could train him on the freeway. If I
had
to.
Yeah.
But I do it gradually. I make sure that I'm doing it in small increments of time, and I make sure that I'm already putting them in the environment they want to be. So say, for example, with ABA, if you say to a kid, if you do this boring task that you don't want to do and that you don't understand why I'm doing, I will give you Thomas the Tank Engine, but not till afterwards. All the kid knows is Thomas the Tank Engine is being promised to me and denied me, and I need Thomas the Tank Engine now. If you take the other approach and say, this kid likes Thomas the Tank Engine, here, let's do everything that we need to do through Thomas the Tank Engine. Let's make the entire thing about Thomas the Tank Engine. Let's have so much Thomas the Tank Engine around this kid that they're so motivated to be with me, that they're able and willing to receive and retain information. You know, a much crasser example is, you know, I'm a fully grown British South African male of the sapient species, so I like boobs and beer. You know, if you want to teach me something boring like physics, which I don't find interesting, and you say, tell you what, Rui, sit in this room and listen to this bloke talking about it, and at the end you can go and have some boobs and some beer, I'll just sit there thinking, boobs and beer, boobs and beer, boobs and beer. Sooner or later this man will shut up and I will be able to go to the place where there are boobs and beer. You know, I'd rather take me to the place where there's boobs and beer and talk to me about physics there.
Yeah.
You know, it's very simple, but it's the difference between application and methodology, which
sure.
is, you know, and one of the problems that I think with people that get into being professionals in this sort of a thing is they're not autism parents and they just don't have the practical expertise.
Mm-hmm.
More and more, we're seeing people who are parents getting into it as professionals, and they often have a much more flexible approach. But a lot of these people are, you know, young women that come out of college, you know, age 25, 26, who know very little about life, unless they happen to grow up with an autistic sibling. You know, they haven't got much to offer, really, other than theories.
Yeah, let me cut in because I want to make sure we get to Mongolia here.
Okay.
And before we get to Mongolia, I would think the demands of dealing with an autistic child would have placed incredible stress on your marriage.
Yes, it is. It is. Any 80% of autism marriages, 80% of special needs marriages break up.
Well, I can believe it.
And the reason is, you know, any cracks that you've got in the relationship, which of course you do, are going to be exposed by this. And if you are not pulling in the same direction and the same cart, then you're like two horses pulling in opposite directions on a cart. The cart's just going to fall over.
Yeah.
And then what happens is the one who's pulling hardest pulls the cart away. And you see this time and time again. And it's so exhausting, you know, and you only have each other to take it out on because nobody else understands, including the often your own parents and things like that, because it's a complete enigma and mystery, and they're not living with it 24/7. So it's very difficult to talk to anyone other than another autism parent about, you know, the vagaries of what goes on with all this. So we realized quite early on in our adventure with this that we were approaching a crisis, and what we decided to do was take the pressure off each other rather than pile more pressure on. So we decided, because we had no babysitting and no extended family around us, and none of our friends could handle Rowan, that we would give each other at least one dedicated night a week off, away.
That was such a smart thing to do.
I tell you, it saved our marriage.
Yeah.
You know, because what happened was in that 12 to 24 hours that each one of us was out, we could remember what it was to be a human being again and,
right.
you know, just recharge and come back fresh and ready. Okay, you know, I'm here. I'm fully here. Let's go, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so now moving it along, somehow you get the idea of taking the family to Mongolia to travel around by horseback searching for a shaman who might be able to help Rowan.
Yes.
Yeah, how did that, I want to ask you how that idea came about, and at the same time I can see that it was a confluence of these various elements.
It wasn't an idea, exactly. It wasn't an idea at all. It was just an organic process that resulted in a sort of gut realization that this was the place that combined the two things that had best ameliorated Rowan's negative symptoms, which were horses and these traditional healers.
It was also two important threads from your own life, And then,
exactly.
And then, of course, there was the encounter with your neighbor's horse, Betsy.
That's right.
Where you described that Rowan kind of ran off from you at one point and threw himself at the feet of this horse, and you were frightened that he was going to get trampled.
Exactly. I mean, I had actually stopped. You know, I'm a lifelong horse guy. I'd stopped riding because I thought Rowan was not safe around horses. I wasn't owning horses anymore. And, you know, I'd given up really the thing in my life that brings me the most pleasure. However, he always did better in nature. His sensory issues were always better in a natural environment than in a man-made environment. There are lots of triggers in man-made environments to do with noise and lights and so on that can throw these neurological switches in these kids. So, but you go out in the woods, they're not there, so the kids are much calmer, much better. So we spent a lot of time in the woods behind our house. We live in the countryside. And one day, instead of turning right along the trail, he went left through the undergrowth before I could grab him, got through the fence into my neighbor's horse pasture, and threw himself at the feet of my neighbor's mare, Betsy. And I initially thought he was going to get trampled, so I'm going really slowly up to the fence to try and grab him and pull him through. But then I noticed something was going on. She bent her head to him and licked and chewed this movement with the mouth, half closing the eye. Now, if you're a horse trainer, that behavior is something you recognize as submission, processing information, and saying, I accept you as the alpha. It's a bit like a dog showing its belly. And the horses do this to each other in the herd structure a lot. And there are techniques which they call natural horsemanship or horse whispering, but they're actually tried and tested techniques where you can get horses to submit to you in this way by certain body language that you use and so on. I'd never seen a horse spontaneously offer this to a human being before, much less a babbling, autistic 2.5-year-old lying on his back. And I realized immediately, oh my gosh, you know, he has some amazing direct line to her. So I started putting him up there, and his tantrums would stop, like almost like a tap being cut off. And when she started moving underneath him, I would sit behind him. He'd sit in front of me in the saddle. He would start to use expressive speech. He had echolalic speech, which is where they repeat stuff randomly, you know, that they've seen on a video or something like that. But it makes no sense. So the first day we rode together, I was just rhetorically talking to him, you know, just for something to do. So I said, do you want to go to the woods or the pond? And he said, to the pond. And I thought, oh, he's echoing. I was just echoing the last thing I said. But we went down to the pond anyway, and this heron got up from the water, and he said, heron. I didn't know if he knew that word. And I realized, oh, my gosh, he's actually speaking. And then from there, it was a very, very quick progression. So we literally started living in the saddle together. And that same year, as I was saying before, I had to bring this delegation of Bushmen hunter-gatherers to the United Nations in the State Department. And some of these guys were trained healers. Some of them worked on Rowan. Got an amazing result. He started losing some of his obsessive behaviors. So it was a very natural thing. It wasn't so much an idea. It was kind of, okay, he's had this radical and positive reaction to the horses, radical and positive reaction to these shamans. I could go to Africa tomorrow, but that's not a horse culture. Where combines shamanism and horses? That's Mongolia. Oh my gosh. If we went there, we could travel on horseback from shaman to shaman. And I just got this gut feeling, if we do that, something's going to change.
Yes, and as if it weren't sufficiently audacious to pack up your wife and autistic son to go off to the wilds of Mongolia with no assurance of how things would turn out, but you also took a film crew. Wow, talk about faith. How did that part come about?
Well, it wasn't really a film crew. It was our friend Jeremy and a filmmaker friend called Michael, who is a filmmaker. And then the only sort of paid professional was a sound guy. The reason that came about was this. I'm a journalist, remember? So I thought, you know, I had this gut feeling that if we go, there's going to be change. If there's change, it ought to be documented. And by the way, if there's no change, it should be documented. Because I kind of thought about that. I was like, well, what if there's no change? And I thought, well, you know what? In a way, that doesn't matter because at least the diagnosis of autism has not prevented us as a family from having an amazing adventure like this as a family. And in fact, it's the autism itself that's opened the doors to adventure. And that alone is kind of worthy of documenting. But if there's change, you know, we really should, you know, because I'm a writer, I knew I'd write a book about it because I'm a writer, that's what I do. But I knew that me as an autism parent, if I was reading that book, I wouldn't maybe appreciate someone saying, oh, I went off over here to this place that you'll never go to, and I met all these people you'll never meet, you know, and you have to take my word for it, you know, that something amazing happened.
Yeah.
There's not a lot necessarily of use to a story like that practically. But if it did work out and it was there, then it becomes part of the general library of information that's out there.
Yeah.
And someone might be able to take certain components from that and say, well, maybe I should try a bit of horse stuff, or maybe I'll go to an Indian reservation and see, you know, what's going on with the traditional healing there, or maybe I'll just get my kid out to nature, or maybe, wow, I don't have to live according to the schedule on a fridge, which is depressing me and the whole family. Maybe I can break out and go do something, you know, a little crazy. Maybe that would actually be good for us. You know, whatever component might be useful. So anyway, initially we thought we'd just sort of go down to Target and buy some handheld, you know, cameras, and just try and keep a camera on him as much as we could. In the event, this filmmaker friend of mine, Michael, found out that we were going, and he's like, you know, I have to film this. And I was like, well, maybe, but there's no money. And he said, doesn't matter, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. In the event, everybody maxed out their credit cards months in advance to get the tickets and
wow.
get stuff. But in the event, we did actually find the budget. Because then when we realized, okay, well, Michael's going to do it, that means, you know, if he does it properly, it'll actually be something worth watching, because he's good at this. Maybe we should actually go up and start asking people for money to do this. And so we did, and to our surprise, we got it. So, but it wasn't a crew. It was three people, you know.
Okay, well, that's a crew.
Well, yes.
Were there any challenges in the making of the film? You know, once you had the money, you found yourself over there. There must have been some things that went wrong.
One or two.
Yeah.
Tons. I mean, you know, when we first got to Mongolia, I'd had about 18 months to plan the trip. And remember, I'm someone who's used to doing expeditions, so I kind of know how to put these things together, and I know how to find the right contacts on the ground and so on and so forth. I go through an extended network of people that I know who do similar stuff. And so like my area is Africa, but I know other people whose area is Northern Asia or what, you know, so I talk to those people and they connected me with very good people on the ground. And then we were back and forth for about 18 months by email, because this is this excellent guy, Tulga, who runs the guiding service that took us out. You know, when I emailed him and said what I wanted to do, he was like, wow.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's a tall order. And by the time we actually arrived, word had got round, and about 9 shamans had gathered from all over the country. Some of them had come 500-600 miles, you know, to work on Rowan. And there was this huge ceremony of 9 shamans on top of a mountain right outside Ulaanbaatar, the capital. And I really thought I'd made a big mistake. Rowan hated it, you know, too much. It was too much noise. It was too much. Went on too long. It was, you know, he just wanted to go play in the river. He was crying. And I was just thinking, wow, you know, have I really messed up here? Do I really have my son's best interests at heart? And then something shifted in the middle of the ceremony, because I really thought maybe I was going to just pack up and go home and admit that I'd made a big mistake. And there were some families there, and he turned to this little Mongolian boy, a little bit older than him, about 6, and opened his arms and hugged him and said, Mongolian brother, never done anything like that.
Wow.
Like the most he'd ever done was what you call parallel play.
Yes.
Where they play next to each other, but they ignore each other. So I thought, well, look, something's going on. So maybe we should persevere. And his whole demeanor changed. He started laughing, giggling, joking, trying to tickle the shamans. It just, everything changed. So we went on across the north of the country. Our objective was Siberia, the bit of Siberia that comes down into northern Mongolia, where the reindeer people live.
Yes.
And their shamans are by reputation, you know, the most effective. But the thing about going to them is they're nomads. So you have to hope that by the time you access their summer pastures, which are 12,000 feet up in a mountain range, that they'll be there. They might be somewhere else. And you only have a set amount of time that you can go in and out for, because there are weather conditions that can affect whether or not you can get up and down through the passes or over the rivers that divide them and that sort of thing. And we had an issue with protein for Rowan because, like many autistic kids, his diet was so specific. So we had tons of bacon, which is kind of all you'd eat at that point. And we cooked it in advance. We could carry on horseback enough for about 8 days before it went bad. So it was a real gamble because it was 3 days, pretty much 2.5 to 3 days to get up the mountain and about the same to get down the mountain. Not allowing for, is it going to have rained and the river's going to be dry and we might have to wait a day for the water to go down or whatever. And we had accidents too. We had wolves come round and spook the horses at night and they ran off and we had to go get them again. One horse we never found again. Wow. You know, having to deal with that. We had to direct the Michael, who's the filmmaker, got really sick. He sadly, this is terrible, I shouldn't ask, but he drank some of the water that we had been using to clean Rowan and got giardia.
Oh my goodness.
And
Chris, you know, Kristen got kicked by a horse. She did.
It was not good. I had an accident in one of the marshes, one of the bogs, where the horse kind of floundered and came down on top of me and I had to kind of throw Rowan to the side and you know, and there was a point at which Rowan really rejected the horses too. I think he felt that they had become sort of an extension of what he had to do rather than what he wanted to do. And I didn't know on the way up north whether he'd actually get back on a horse again. We were sort of in a 4x4 up until a certain point where you can't get a vehicle any further. So my heart was in my mouth. And then when he did in the event get on a horse again, but what got him up the mountain was toilet humor. and then he started loving it again at a certain point. But then, you know, there was this thing, well, will they be there? And even if they are there, will the shaman be with them? Because the shamans move around. And if the shaman is with them, will the shaman feel that he can work on Rowan? Because it wasn't like we could ring him up on his cell phone and chat with him beforehand. So there were lots of anxieties and questions.
You know, in the film, you share the reflection that you had come to see that the challenges of raising an autistic child were something of a gift, that you were
a
far better father as a result of those difficulties than you would have been without them. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the thing is, I'm as lazy as the next man, and I'm as selfish as the next man. So if I could have fallen back on the do-it-because-I-say-so form of parenting, I probably would have, because it's a lot easier. Autism, that choice is taken away from me. If you try that, the child will just withdraw from you and go internal. So you have to always go the extra mile. You have to, they don't speak your language. You have to learn to speak their language with no manual. With no, you know, you have to, your patience, your everything has to exponentially increase or you just aren't going to make it. And autistic kids, particularly when they're very young, are not very forgiving. If you make a mistake, it can take you a long time, like if you shout at them or something because you reached the end of your tether, it might be a while before you can get them back. You know, you've got to be careful. So like spooking a young horse, you know, you've got to be very careful. So you've got to be more aware, you've got to be more mindful, you've got to be, not because you want to be, not because you're a better human being, not because of any of those reasons, simply because you have no choice. But the net result is that it does make you a better parent, for sure. Yeah. I think pretty much all special needs parents I've met, you know, seem to have acquired these qualities. And then they're a gift with autism itself, which you start to see that once you start addressing the sensory problems, which are like a white noise of physical discomfort and mental discomfort that prevent the child from showing what their true intellect is. Once those are ameliorated, being on a horse seems to be one way to do it. Then the kid's intellect comes to the fore, and you realize that a lot of these kids are extremely gifted intellectually, sometimes to a savant-like degree. And that they also have qualities of mind that are different. So, for example, they're not as ruled by the ego as people who are not autistic are. They don't worry about where they are in the pecking order. They don't worry about if they're rich enough, thin enough, fast enough, beautiful enough, tall enough, anything like that. They just are who they are. And that is a really great gift because it allows them, once they can focus, to really get on with the job in hand. And also, they just don't go through the same kind of psychological angst that a lot of we neurotypical people go through. On top of that, it starts blurring the boundary between who's the therapist here, because being around autistic people, I find, kind of gives you a break from your own ego. And you end up with a slightly quieter mind while you're around them. Even if the moment you walk out of that door or get off the horse, or you go back into the neurotypical world and suddenly I'm dealing with my ego again in just the same way. At least I've had a break from it for a while. It's rather like being in the presence of an enlightened master, seriously. Mm. And so there are great gifts here. And I was starting to see these more and more. By the time we got out to Mongolia, I truly wasn't interested in Rowan being cured. You said at the beginning of the interview that we were looking for a cure. I can promise you we were not looking for a cure. But to my mind, there is a difference between the word healing and the word cure. And I think that's why there are different semantics for the two. Cure, to me, implies the almost surgical removal of something. So it's not there anymore, which is not possible with autism. Autism is a way of being. It's a personality type. It's who the person is intrinsically. However, healing, to my mind, implies the grand amelioration of negative symptoms of a condition that is probably chronic, to the point that the condition is simply a condition and no longer a disorder or a dysfunction or a disease. And that definitely happened in Mongolia. Rowan went out autistic and he came back autistic. He did not get cured of his autism. Shamanism does not cure autism. Horses do not cure autism. However, he went out with three key dysfunctions alongside his autism, which were his incontinence, his tantruming all the time due to sensory stuff, and his inability to make friends. He came back without those three key dysfunctions. So he came back a much more functional autistic person who then started amazing us with his sort of intellectual gifts and so on, and who still does to this day. But yes, at this stage, I find autism, even by then, I find autism so fascinating, so interesting, that I was no longer looking for a cure as such. I just wanted to ameliorate his suffering.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful result. Now, as a result of all of this, you created an equestrian center for handicapped children on your ranch, and you've also created a horse boy foundation. So as we kind of wrap things up here, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about those two efforts.
Well, what I did is I realized that so many wonderful things have come together in our life to allow us to do this. They hadn't taken money. They'd taken certain types of physical circumstances where we lived. We live in rural Texas. There's horses everywhere. You know, we live in the woods. But to buy a three-bedroom house with some acres in rural Texas would not buy you, a closet in somebody's apartment in Oakland. You know, I mean, these are different economies that we're dealing with. So I thought, well, what do you do if you're not fortunate enough to live in that place, you know?
Yes.
I thought, well, we need to found a foundation that gets kids to them. So we have the Horse Boy Foundation, and what the Horse Boy Foundation does is it raises money to send children who wouldn't normally have access to horses to places that we have trained specifically to do the work that we call now Horse Boy Method.
Mm-hmm.
In the Horse Boy Method, we go all over the world training this now. It's basically all the stuff that worked for Rowan. And then we field tested it on other autistic kids. We found it worked for the majority of them too. And it's all about direct communication. It's not about curing autism. It's about getting direct communication and helping with the negative sensory stuff. So we have about 11 main techniques that we train both horses and people in, and they are quite effective. And they're semi-effective on a week-to-week level, but they're highly effective if you do like a camp of 3 days and there's a weird immersion. They also address the whole family. It doesn't just address the kid. I mean, remember this, the Mongolia thing was an adventure we had as a whole family. It helps bring the parents back together again. They're out there sleeping in nature, you know, with their kid, having this adventure on horseback, even if it's only a 3-day one, you know. They're surrounded by other autism parents who can exchange information and who aren't judging them or thinking they're terrible parents because they're not, you know, slapping their kid when he has a mental meltdown. Because you people will walk up to you in the supermarket and say that you're a terrible parent all the time. You know?
Right.
It addresses that kind of isolation. It also addresses the needs of the siblings because, you know, let's say we've got a brother who's not interested in horses, but his autistic brother's doing stuff with the horses on a camp. What are we going to do with the brother? Well, we have people come in and teach them martial arts, you know, stuff like that. Or maybe it's a sister and she's pony mad. Well, we'll teach her to ride. You know? Mm-hmm. So suddenly their sibling's condition, which was shutting doors for them, is suddenly causing doors to open and dreams to be fulfilled. But we also have found kids becoming verbal on these camps. And, you know, we had this kid on our camp recently. We do the sensory work with him where we lay the child on the horse like a big old couch, really. And they frequently fall asleep up there. And this kid fell asleep. He hadn't ever slept more than 3 hours before.
Oh my goodness.
We transferred him to a bed. He slept for 14 hours, you know. And it can be quite radical, the shifts that you see.
So, you know, one of the other gifts that came out of your son's autism is it created this whole new life for you, this whole new mission.
Yeah.
and almost a whole new occupation in addition.
Yeah.
to all your other occupations.
Mad.
you know, Rupert, I'm so impressed by your courage and your adventurous spirit and the big heart that you've developed. And I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's been a great honor. Thank you very, very much indeed.
I know you will have enjoyed this fascinating story about Isaacson's horse boy adventure. By the way, you'll surely want to hear my interview with his wife, Kristen, about her book on self-compassion. That interview is either currently or soon will be on my other interview series at wisecounselpodcast.com. There was so much more that I would have liked to explore and draw out in this interview that time did not allow. One detail that comes up in the book, and maybe the film as well, is that both the Kalahari Bushman shaman and the Mongolian shaman recognized Rowan as someone like themselves, someone who in their own cultures would be destined to become a shaman himself. Indeed, this fits well with anthropological research, which teaches us that shamans are often called to that role as a result of special talents or proclivities arising out of an affliction. This in turn reminds me of Jung's observation that only the wounded healer will be truly effective. In the film, it was clear that animals in general were extremely tolerant of Rowan. It wasn't just the horse Betsy, but also other animals would patiently allow him to pull, poke, twist, and otherwise inflict himself on them, somehow recognizing that he was deserving of a level of tolerance they wouldn't normally extend to human beings. Similarly, it was wonderful to see how Rowan bonded with the young son of their Mongolian interpreter. I have the impression that this was perhaps the first occasion in which Rowan played interactively with another child compared to the mere parallel play he had previously engaged in. The Mongolian boy was maybe 2 years older than Rowan, but language was no barrier for them, and they chased and tumbled like two young cubs. It was delightful to witness. I can't urge you strongly enough to watch this film. It is available through both Netflix and Hulu.com. Also, Rupert's book by the same title, The Horse Boy, is a delightful read and is available on Amazon.com, where I was able to download the Kindle version for the amazingly affordable price of $2.95. For parents of an autistic child or interested professionals, Rupert was eager that I share two websites devoted to that aspect of his work. You'll find one at horseboyfoundation.org and the other at horseboymethod.com. I also had an intuition that Rupert might have some excellent suggestions/contacts for other fascinating guests, not necessarily about autism, and indeed he gave me some wonderful recommendations. So, as ever, stay subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio for future surprises.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his Shrink Wrap Radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink Wrap Radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hello, everyone. First of all, I want to give you a heads up that there may be some changes in the format of future shows. Currently, as you may or may not know, Shrink Wrap Radio is part of the Mevio network. They're the ones that bring us our Angie's List, ShoeBuy, and 4 Inkjet sponsors. I'm in the process of exploring having Shrink Wrap Radio appear on yet another network. And they're asking for some changes, mostly in terms of how the show opens and closes. Now, never fear, I'll still be bringing you the same great interviews, but I'll be playing around a bit with the intro, how I get into those interviews, and maybe with what comes after. So I hope you won't be thrown off by any of these changes. Next, I'd like to let you know that there is a new interview up on my Wise Counsel podcast series. This one was a little slow in coming because of some changes at that network. The latest interview is with Shrink Wrap Radio listener Marshall Lewis on logotherapy. Logotherapy, as you may know, is the approach developed by the famous psychoanalyst and existential therapist Viktor Frankl. And Marshall Lewis, who is in the final stages of completing his doctoral program, is quite expert on the topic of Frankl and logotherapy, so I think you'll get a lot out of that interview. Also, I'm pleased to announce that we have a new transcript on the site, thanks to longtime Israeli listener and contributor, Dr. Cody Lapid. She's transcribed number 264, Beyond Forgiveness, Reflections on Atonement, with Phil Cousineau. Thank you so much for doing that transcription, Dr. Lapid. We have some other transcriptions in process that I hope will be forthcoming before too long. If you're interested in volunteering to be a transcriber, please be sure to drop me a line. You might recall that I'm also a blogger for the Psychology Today magazine's website, and I've finally gotten around to putting up another post titled Goodbye Happiness, Hello Well-Being. You can find it if you Google the title of my blog series, which is The Happiness Dispatch. Now, among other things, my blog is about positive psychology, which if you've been listening for a while, you know I'm interested in. I'm happy to announce that I'm going to be attending the second annual International Positive Psychology Association Conference, which will be held in Philadelphia over July 23rd, 24, 25, and 26. So you can expect that I'll be lining up some good interviews there and may do a series of short interviews at the conference itself. Don't forget to use the discount codes on our site to save money and help support the show. You'll find the links to the discounts on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. Look for the links to shoebuy.com, 4inkjets.com, and angieslist.com, as I mentioned earlier. Angie's List is strictly for those of you who live in the U.S., unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon how you look at it. And you know how useful and valuable user ratings of others are on such sites as Amazon.com and the Apple Store and other websites where users rate products or services. I know those always provide me with a certain amount of guidance. Well, Angie's List takes that idea and applies it to a wide variety of services offered in your area. So whether you need a dentist or a plumber or a masseuse or a contractor, you should check Angie's List for any recommendations or ratings that they might have. And you'll save 25% with the discount code SHRINK. Your use of these discount codes do save you money, and they also provide Shrink Wrap Radio with a trickle of income. That's why your donations are particularly important as well. So just look for the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com, and I'll say thanks in advance.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio. ShrinkWrapRadio.com.
Thank you, Adam Curry, who will not be my guest on the next episode. Let me go ahead and read a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Amy, who writes, "Like your podcasts and appreciate the hours of dedication you put into them. Since I'm personally dealing with this, I'd like to suggest a show on video game addiction among the youth. An acquaintance told me that she read a young mother starved her baby to death by neglect because she was so occupied with the online game world. No idea if this is true, but after seeing some of the things my 12-year-old does to satisfy his addiction, it sounds believable to me. Game playing in China is also now government regulated, and they are reporting huge problems with the 10 to 13-year-old age group. My boys are 4 years apart, and the older one has a different relationship with the PC. Has the game world really changed so drastically in such a short period? I can't remove the computer from my son's world, as being computer savvy is a necessity. It's more like overeaters who just can't stop eating. Love to hear how this is being dealt with in this young age group, where one honestly cannot expect a 12-year-old to admit and understand he has an addiction and needs help like one could talk with an adult. Many thanks." And that's from Amy. And I wrote back to Amy saying, "Hi, Amy, thanks for the suggestion. I think it's a really good one. I did a search on Amazon and found a very positively reviewed book by one Kevin Roberts titled Cyber Junkie. It's only $10 on Amazon, and I'd recommend you get a copy. And I also saw a number of other interesting titles there by searching on video game addiction, so you might want to do the same. Even though he's not a psychologist and I haven't read his book yet, the reader reviews persuaded me that the author of Cyber Junkie would make a good guest. I called him, and I'm going to have him on the show down the road." Next, we hear from Trevor Ehrman, who sent along this nice note in relation to his becoming a Shrink Wrap Radio donor. He wrote, "Hello, David. You are very welcome. I feel honored to be able to donate to your wonderful efforts. I really think it is the least I can do for all that I receive. Thank you for all that you do. Keep up the great work. Respectfully, Trevor Ehrman." Oh, Trevor, thank you so much for that vote of support. Finally, here's one more. This one is from Kim, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I have something I need to get off my chest, and unfortunately, you're going to be the one to take the brunt of it. Before I get started, however, I'd like to say how much I enjoy your podcasts on Shrink Wrap Radio. I discovered you by browsing iTunes about a month ago, and have listened to many of your podcasts and have learned from them and been entertained by them. I especially enjoy your personality. You are kind, intelligent, patient, curious, open-minded, and humble. You are also a great interviewer with a gentle sense of humor. Maybe that's why I feel safe sharing this with you. And I'm glad you do feel safe sharing it with me. My complaint is towards something that can be found not only on your podcast, but in society at large at this point in history. And that is a shameless, gleeful bigotry against Christianity. The intelligentsia are the worst offenders, and there seems to be agreement that it is acceptable and even virtuous to degrade us. In this day, most intelligent people would not speak about Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, or atheists the way they talk about Christians. It's politically incorrect. However, it is now politically correct to deride Christianity, and it's so widespread in its practice that I don't think people know they are doing it. It's as if they believe they are being judgmental about something that is obviously detestable, something that we as reasonable people can all agree is not worthy of respect. I'm sure we're being judged by the lunatic fringe that make the headlines, the guy who said the world was ending, the priests who molest children, the people who call other people sinners and say they're going to hell, the televangelists who con money out of the elderly, Mel Gibson. But these people do not represent the majority of Christians. True Christians are sincere people who strive to be peace-loving, generous, serene, tolerant, and kind. We're to see other people as greater than ourselves. We're to judge the sin, but not the sinner. We're to be sacrificial and help the poor, the lonely, and the imprisoned. We're not to judge lest we be judged ourselves. We're to love our enemies. The people who are living this way are, by definition, not in the public eye. They're quiet, humble, self-effacing, and hard-working. And there are many of us. I would venture to say the majority of Christians attempt to live such lives. We're not perfect, and that is something that true Christians feel deeply and are quick to acknowledge. Many scholars throughout history have been devout Christians. C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, Thomas Aquinas, and St. Augustine, to mention a few. I know that you know this, but I just want to stress it because there is a widespread notion that Christianity is for the simple-minded and that only ignorant people can follow such a faith. Christianity has the advantage of being simple enough at its core for a child to understand, but rich and deep enough in its complexities that many scholarly tomes have been written about its doctrines. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I have felt as symptomatic of this attitude on your podcast. In Life Among the Piraha, Daniel Everett shows obvious discomfort in admitting he was once a Christian, as if it's a shameful thing to admit. That made me sad, and Phil Cousineau, when talking about atonement, a central Christian theme, dances around Christianity in a hopeless effort to avoid mentioning it. And when he does finally mention it, there's a rush to get through it. It's obviously distasteful to him and to you, I can tell. Why? Why can't Christianity get the same respect as Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, and things like shamanism and intuition? Perhaps I'm mistaken. I haven't looked through all the archives. Maybe there are some interviews with people who are proud to admit they're Christians and who talk as openly about their faith as S.H. Breslin did about her self-described, quotes, woo-woo approach to treating people with PTSD. I listened to her with respect and took her seriously. Why is that no longer the attitude towards Christians and Christianity? Christianity is a dirty word right now, and I'm deeply hurt by the judgment and ridicule I feel directed at me and my fellow believers. Everyone wants to claim they're, quote, spiritual and not, quote, religious, because they want to distance themselves from anything that smells even faintly of me. Ouch. Think about my comments. See if you can find evidence of this prejudice in modern movies, TV, books, and radio, in which Christians are often portrayed as mean, stupid, or crazy. I think you'll be surprised how glaring it is and how easy it is to overlook if you're not a Christian. Thank you for listening, Kim. Well, I thought that was a very useful, well-written, well-thought-out critique. I wrote back to Kim, and here's what I wrote. Hi, Kim. Thanks for taking the time to write, to express your feelings so frankly. It's a good caution for me to hear. I think the point you make is a good one, and I will try to be more aware of it as I go forward. I'm not likely to confront my guests unless they say something truly egregious. I certainly want to mind my own bias, though, as carefully as possible. I was more or less raised as a fundamentalist evangelical Christian. I later came to reject that because of the absolutist notion that every non-Christian would burn in hell. It's the idea that Christianity has an exclusive hold on the truth that I cannot abide. It's that fundamental certainty and self-righteousness, whether Islamic or Christian, that I find offensive. Having said that, I very much value the fact that I grew up on Bible stories and am steeped in that whole part of Western cultural history and ethical sensibility. I attended a Christian high school and recently have found some of my classmates online from way back when. I must confess to being surprised that the ones I knew have held to their belief. And I've been glad to discover that I still like them now, just as I did back then. So thanks again for your important reminder regarding tolerance and respect. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. And of course, my voicemail is 206-337-0622. Thanks to Rupert Isaacson for sharing his inspiring story with us. On the next episode, my guest will be Dr. Temple Grandin. If you have access to Netflix, be sure to get and watch the film that's titled Temple Grandin, and that will add greatly to your enjoyment of the interview. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.